or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
In the aftermath of the Baltimore protests, or riots, whatever you choose to characterize them as, President Obama last month ordered $450 million in new job training grants, the so-called TAC, T-A-A-C-C-C-T, Trade Adjustment Assistance, Community College and Career Training Grants. Indeed, many community activists and political leaders say that the anger in the community is always caused in part by the many residents who don't have good-paying, good-quality jobs. On the other hand, I read a review of the effectiveness of job training programs a few years ago in the New York Times, and then more recently, another one in the Wall Street Journal, both of which, to be polite, raised serious questions about the cost-effectiveness of such training and the wisdom of their use as that much of our taxpayer dollars. Most of us remember the soundbite that each job created by the Obama stimulus cost $278,000. So, in the wake of what happened in Baltimore and the just-announced $450 million in new job training taxpayer-funded programs, it seems like a good time to take a look at how much hope we can realistically place on job training. So with me to discuss the issue are Stephen Bader. He's the executive director of the Workforce Investment Board of Contra Costa County, who oversees many taxpayer-funded job training programs and believes in them, as evidenced, for example, by an op-ed he wrote in this year's Contra Costa Times, in which the first paragraph said, quote, "California must continue to invest in workforce development," end quote. Stephen Bader, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you for letting me be here.
My pleasure. And far less confident about whether job training is a wise use of taxpayer dollars is Jim Bovard. He is the author of the aforementioned article in the Wall Street Journal, questioning the value of job training programs, the position he also took when he testified before Congress. Jim Bovard, welcome to you as well.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Well, here's how we're going to structure things. We're going to start, as I've told you, both of you, this, of course, off the air, but I want our listeners to be clued in. We'll start with each of you making a two-minute opening statement. Stephen, you'll start by taking 2 minutes to explain why you believe that job training programs indeed are a cost-effective use of taxpayer dollars. Then, Jim, you'll have 2 minutes to explain why you believe taxpayer-paid job training programs are not a cost-effective use of taxpayer dollars. Then, for roughly 10, 15 minutes, you'll have a free-form exchange about it, in which you should both feel free to acknowledge the other person's good points. This is not like a formal debate where you have to stick to your position. It's a hybrid between a conversation and a debate. I'll interject only if one person's taking much more than half the time, or if the conversation's getting redundant. I'll then ask a question so you can explore some different part of the issue. And we'll end with each of you having 90 seconds, roughly, to make a closing statement that hopefully will, rather than reiterate your opening statement, show some sort of change that occurred as a result of your conversation. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Very good.
Okay, terrific. So, let's start, Stephen Bader. 2 minutes, tell us why you believe that job training programs, taxpayer-funded job training programs, are a wise use of taxpayer dollars.
Sure. Well, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here, Marty. And, you know, I think the important thing to really underscore from the get-go is that, you know, in deference to the very subject here, is that there's no doubt about the fact that there's a mixed bag in terms of what's out there in terms of job training programs. But at the end of the day, those that are done well really are ones that are economically strategic, and they understand how to really maximize the value of human capital and assets in a local or regional economy. You know, businesses fundamentally need to have, you know, need to be able to access workers who know how to add value and create opportunity for companies to grow and thrive. And, you know, that also in turn feeds into the economic cycle with, you know, creating consumers and folks who can actually benefit from the products and services that those companies create and generate in the market. At the same time, you know, the other thing is that without a doubt, as we look about, you know, what's coming out, the context of coming out of one of the deepest recessions in a couple of generations, there's no doubt that, you know, things that can happen in the economic cycle can be far more disruptive than we might have initially thought. And, you know, seeing what happened in the 2008-2010 downturn period and the number of people, falling out of the labor force, people with great skills, people with lots of education experience who fundamentally had to kind of reinvent themselves and look at what's happening. And I think there's no doubt about seeing what's happened with some of those folks and coming forward, that it really underscores the point that you can't take these kinds of investments for granted, that fundamentally they're about strategically aligning both the market and the public's investments to really create opportunity across the board.
Thank you very much, Stephen Bader. And Jim Bovard, you are less confident that it's a wise use of taxpayer dollars. Make the case. You have roughly 2 minutes.
Okay. There's not any doubt that job skills are important, but but the fundamental question is whether the government is competent to provide those skills. Federal job training programs have relied on a train and pray approach. What we do is train people, and we pray that they get a job. These are not my words. These are from President Obama giving a speech last year. President Obama mentioned often he was very critical of the fact there's been so little evaluation of federal job training programs that we really don't know what's working, what's not. President Obama promised to fix the programs, but for more than 40 years we've heard presidents promise to fix these programs. The federal government has now run more than 100 different job training programs since the 1960s. Dozens of them were targeted at youth, but the government has consistently betrayed people who trusted Uncle Sam to give them marketable skills. There have been a stack of federal audit reports that have shown that the federal job training programs from the 1960s on have undermined young people's work ethic. They've exposed them to places where good work habits were not learned. Kids who signed up for government job training programs, summer jobs, were less likely to be hired by private employers because those kids tend to have a bad attitude towards work in many cases. And it's not a question of intentions, because there are a lot of folks in the job training community who are trying to do their best, and I'm sure there are some good local programs. But the fundamental problem is the federal programs crafted by Congress and Labor Department have consistently failed to deliver for either taxpayers or for the trainees. There was a study on CETA, which was a big program in the 1970s through early 80s. It showed significant earnings losses for young men of all races who were in the program. CETA was recognized as a boondoggle. It was replaced by the Job Training Partnership Act. A decade later, the feds admitted that program had also lowered the earnings of young males who were out of school.
You know what? I'm going to interrupt you for right. interest of fairness of time. These are all issues that the two of you can bring up in the course of your frequent conversation. But I want to let listeners know that you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guests are Stephen Bader and Jim Bovard, and they are having a discussion / debate on a critical question in light of the unrest now that occurred in Cleveland as well, in Ferguson and in Baltimore, and now in Cleveland. Many of the leaders are saying that some of the anger that exists in the community is for the lack of good jobs. And so President Obama has released an additional new $450 million in job training grants. And so I thought it would be a perfect time to have a discussion, debate, / on the subject. And I'm talking with Stephen Bader, who is the executive director of the Workforce Investment Board of Contra Costa County, and Jim Bovard, who's written in the Wall Street Journal and testified before Congress saying that they're just not effective. Now we're going to turn to a roughly 10 to 15 minute free-form conversation between the two of you, in which you'll just exchange ideas. You don't have to stick to your position either way. I want you to be informed by each other. It's a conversation like you're having a beer together, and you're respectful of each other. You're taking roughly 50% of the time. You're not talking too long, like I've just started to do. And please begin.
Well, it's sort of early in the morning for a beer, but what the heck?
Right.
Agreed. Maybe not in San Francisco.
No, it's certainly early in the morning for here, yes. I think just in quick response to Jim, to part of what you were saying, I think, I think we all know, in fact, that the debate's been going on for a while. And in fact, it's happened, and most recently last summer, when Congress, enacted with wide, amazing bipartisan support, the newest piece of legislation, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, by a vote of 4-15-6, with 11 people not voting. And so, really, I think what we're here talking about is fundamentally is, as that vote has now happened and that perspective shared, I think sort of where, from where I sit anyways, it's really about how does the investment that's being made really realize its potential as envisioned by folks who are supporting it across the board.
Well, I mean, part of my skepticism is, okay, Congress came up with a new name. I mean, it's it's somewhat like someone who changes their name after they file for bankruptcy, which we've been seeing. There's a lot of similarities in the programs over the last 50 years, and about once a decade or once every 15 years, the programs get a new name. They're often run in localities by the same people or the same organizations, and I haven't seen a learning curve where they really recognize the basic mistakes that were made. And it's nice that Congress passed that bill last year, perhaps, But President Obama was making a big pitch early last year saying that there have not been good evaluations of the program. We don't know what works. And then Congress rushed through a bill, and I don't see any reason to presume that Congress knew what worked when it wrote the bill.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, so some of those points I can't argue with. I think at the same time, you know, I think the train and pray reference is very apt. It's one that's been used for quite a while. And I would say that, you know, I would tell you that the investments that are being made today are without a doubt, you know, moving much more toward a demand-driven, market-driven approach where you're seeing, you know, the kinds of things that are happening now and certainly in what I've experienced across both the region and where I am in the Bay Area, but really across California and the nation, is much more employer investment. You're seeing businesses, you know, come to the table saying, look, we have some bona fide gaps right now where we need to find some qualified talent. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that we need to people coming in the door in our candidate pool to be able to perform and deliver on. And that in and of itself is really helping to drive a lot of the kinds of things that are being put into place. And so while things in the 60s and 70s may have been very much about sort of creating work and putting people in a spot and giving them a paycheck and starting to count widgets, I would tell you that in today's marketplace, which is much more dynamic and really is reflective of, you know, what's happening in the global economy, it's really about skill development and skill acquisition that's going to drive innovation and product opportunity in the market. And this is how you really leverage a public-private partnership.
Well, part of my skepticism on this issue is it's certainly good that the programs are not relying on the 1970s quasi-therapy approach of just trying to make people feel good and get a good self-concept. But as far as being focusing on what businesses need on as you mentioned, a market-driven approach, that's a little bit some of the same rhetoric was used in the 1980s for the Job Training Partnership Act, which was one of Reagan's big innovations. Dan Quayle was a mastermind there, God bless us. And that was supposed to make the job training programs much more focused on what businesses actually needed. But what turned out to be, it just turned out to be a slush fund for businesses. And there was a vast amount of subsidies and for businesses that did not influence the training that they did. According to Labor Department records, at one point the job that was being trained for most often around the nation was janitor, which is not really something which you need to be fairly subsidizing. There was massive subsidies for places like McDonald's that would be hiring workers. You know, it doesn't matter if there's a federal subsidy. So I'm very leery of any federal program which would be giving direct or indirect subsidies to businesses, because this is not what for-profit enterprises should be getting.
Right. And absolutely. And I would tell you the kinds of things that we're seeing across the board are not subsidies per se. They're really about leveraged investments, and they're about being able to bring together resources that are happening not just within the direct investments that are coming under the Department of Labor, but across the board in other systems, in K-12 education, community colleges, and four-year institutions, both public and private, in fact, where you're really looking at how do you make things more relevant and resonant for businesses? Because, you know, the notion even, I don't want to take us afield in terms of what the educational system's delivering or not, but there's been a pretty big disconnect historically between how education thinks of itself in terms of preparing people for careers. And I think what you're seeing now, especially as, you know, you talk about things that have happened over time, whether in the 60s it was this kind of dynamic and in the 80s it was a different dynamic, you know, the economy's changing so much more rapidly now, and that's putting downward pressure on wages. It's increasing competition across the board in the market for business opportunities. And so it's really creating the imperative right now. The skill investment is the focus in terms of how you help drive forward momentum and create opportunity.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. We're having a conversation / debate about the question of, is the latest iteration of job training programs that you've just announced, $450 million that President Obama announced, is it likely to be a good use of taxpayer dollars? I'm talking with Jim Bovard, who wrote critically about that in the Wall Street Journal and testified before Congress, and Stephen Bader, who is the executive director of the Workforce Investment Board in Contra Costa County. I want to actually, before I let you go back to Freeform, I've got a couple of questions I want to ask each of you. Jim, the reality is that the only thing that the leaders talk about in terms of offering any hope are education and job training. If you simply dismiss job training as a viable alternative, because of the past failures. There's got to have been some learning, some evaluations. You know, it feels like you're sending somebody into the boxing ring with one arm tied behind his back, the job training. We agree, I think, I also have seen Stephen nod that indeed that the efficacy of these programs has been, let's be generous, spotty. But do you really want to dismiss them as broadly as you seem to be dismissing them, Jim Beaufort?
Well, there's an unfortunate set of incentives here, and that is that presidents and politicians can win applause and get great PR by promising to give young people and others job training. And this is what's driven the program since the 1960s. It was a huge thing with President Reagan with the Job Training Partnership Act. President Obama has been pushing that button lately. But there is no way to have the same incentives for the government versus what you would have in a private company, which lives or dies depending on the competence of its workers. And it's a fundamental question of incentives, and there is no possible reform that will solve that. And the basic point is that if the government promises to give people skills and the government does not deliver, people are a lot worse off than if they realize that they were on their own and that there's not going to be some government agency riding over the hill on a white horse to fix their life for them.
That gives rise to a question I have now for you, Stephen. You know, there at the linchpin of all of this, at the core of all of this, is there have been job training programs forever, and they've always, my PhD's in evaluation, and when I got it, we were already learning about the criticality of evaluation, starting with Head Start in 1970. You've had now a half a century of programs, and they've normally blown off the evaluation. The evaluation requirements are there, but they've been blown off by hiring people to evaluate who are, you know, not really that qualified, or who are palliative, would say the nice words. Is not the problem that they haven't been evaluated, but is really the problem that the jobs that are available, and I was in preparing for the show, I noticed, for example, there are jobs in technical support for Salesforce. There are jobs, there is too big a disconnect between the needs of the employment situation, of the employers, and the kind of people who you are serving.
Well, I think there's no doubt, Marty, that you're seeing, you know, a bifurcation right now in the labor market where there's a, you know, growing number of jobs at the top and a growing number of jobs at the bottom, fewer in the middle. And part of the value proposition fundamentally about the, you know, the new direction that's happening at the federal level on down, and really it's being driven by what's happening in regional economies across the nation, and that's kind of more been a way in which it's informed the federal policy as it's been unfolding, it's really about, you know, trying to help folks, you know, be able to realize some of those career opportunities that are in those higher wage, higher growth industries, and at the same time be very strategic about the investments. And to Jim's point, I think, which is fair, you have to look at over time, while there may have been different kinds of messaging and rhetoric around what may have been happening in prior investments under prior pieces of legislation, if you look at the aggregate level of investment, it's actually shrunk dramatically over time, especially relative to the size of GDP. So
I need to ask a follow-up because you didn't quite answer the question. The question was about the disconnect between the level of competence that is required in the jobs that are extant, like that's like tech support for Salesforce, and the quality of the people. I have, for example, visited high schools in the inner city doing some volunteer work, and I am shocked at the high percentage of those students who can't read on more than a sixth grade level, whose math reasoning skills are essentially zero. And as a career counselor, which is my day job, I see highly competent people who can't get jobs in tech support for Salesforce. Is there not too big a disconnect between where the jobs are and the qualifications of the people that you're training?
So obviously that gets into more longitudinal kinds of impact, and what I would say to that point is that, you know, the investments that are happening right now are designed to give people the first couple of legs up if they're starting from a very, you know, place of very, you know, serious need and really need in skill building requirements. At the same time, what I'd tell you is that, you know, the connection relative to what's happening at the higher end is there, and if you set the right path and be able to put people on the opportunity to climb that scaffolding, that it will be there. But it is a long-term investment.
And, you know, because I asked two tough questions for Stephen, I feel it's fair. I want to ask one more tough question to you, Jim. It is, you know, even though I really do, I have a PhD in evaluation from Berkeley, I know the field cold. It is nonetheless very difficult to measure the effectiveness of any social program. There are so many side benefits, so many what are called covariates, other factors affecting things. So shouldn't we really, instead of relying on evaluation, which is what you were doing in arguing against them, shouldn't we rely heavily on logic? And logically, it seems logical to support a program that teaches even those job readiness skills, waking up to an alarm clock, showing up at work, anger management, the skills that are needed to do the basic technical jobs, or install solar panels. How can you argue against that?
Well, Marty, it's a very interesting concept of logic you have, where the first thing which we do is brush all the evidence aside. It doesn't make any sense to throw out the federally funded evaluations in most cases. It would also be possible for me to throw out a blizzard of anecdotes, boondoggles, and quotes from people who have been shafted by their programs, things like that. The reason that I mentioned the evaluations is this is something which people on both sides should recognize is credible evidence. And it's, you know, once again, it's not a question of helping people by supporting your program. If the program isn't working nationwide, and again, going back to what Obama said last year, train and pray. We train people, we pray to get a job. This is, I mean, after you've been doing something for 50 years and you're still praying and shooting in the dark, this is not encouraging. But it's simply a question, there is no reason that we should assume that the next reform will be able to get it right, and there is no reason for young people to count on the government to give them a skill any more. You know, it was a great example you mentioned of going to schools and seeing kids that couldn't read at more than the sixth grade level. The government utterly failed to give kids to help kids get basic literacy and fluency with math. And there's no reason to think another government program is going to be able to somehow give them job skills.
Steve Bader.
Yes, I think, you know, an interesting point on that is that, you know, I think we can talk about where the government's failed or not, but I think we all know, too, at the end of the day, there's certainly a piece of individual responsibility around all this. But back to, you know, one other thing I just want to mention, Marty, in response to the evaluation piece, is that in 2011 in California, we did a benefit cost analysis, a third-party benefit cost analysis by an outside evaluator to take a look at the impact of these kinds of investments in California. More than 110,000 people were served, more than 50,000 people into jobs. But most importantly, if you look at the input-output ratio, for every dollar invested in these programs, there was an average of, you know, the return on that value was $1.89. So basically, for every dollar you put in, you got $1.89 back in the economy. So back to where I started on this when we first got going this morning is that this is really about how do you maximize economic opportunity and create value in the market.
So now, Jim, he just said that there is a fairly substantial-sized program which yielded $1.89 for every dollar. You have a response to that?
If memory serves, that's almost the exact same number that the Secretary of Agriculture said that that is a multiplier benefit from giving out food stamps. That for every dollar in food stamps given, it creates $1.85 or $1.89. I think the Obama administration also said that for every dollar of unemployment benefits given, it creates $2. But these are very narrow. I'm not familiar with his study regarding the government spending for job programs and the return on that, but I know most of the time when I hear people using claiming a multiplier, it's at least around here it's smoke and mirrors, and you shake the numbers a little bit, don't find much.
Well, that's why before I got my PhD in evaluation, I was the subscriber to Consumer Reports from day one because I believe
great.
In evaluation, but the longer I've been in the game, the more I realize how much massaging. It's who you choose as the evaluator, what they choose to study, how they determine $1.89 in benefits. It's. I wouldn't go as far as saying smoke and mirrors. That's too strong as far as I'm concerned. But it certainly doesn't give one the confidence to spend the $450 million. It's tough. We have to rely on logic. I want to, before we go to closing statements, I'd like each of you to ask the other person a question. Instead of me asking questions, either one of you can start. What question are you really curious, honestly curious about what the other person has to say?
Shall I start?
Please, either way. Sure.
Okay. Well, I've been chewing on this, and I'd be interested to hear what Stephen thought of the level of the competence or wisdom of the guidance which he's received from the Labor Department, and also how many times has the Labor Department shifted directions or issued new standards or new regs which made it more difficult for him to run his job training program.
That's a great question, Jim. I think there's no doubt about the fact when you work in a publicly funded system that, you know, one is subject to a lot of rules, regulations, policies, procedures that can sometimes making getting things done difficult and in some cases even fly in the face of common sense. At the same time, what I would say is that, things evolve for a reason. We're not in our grandfather's economy. We're not in our father's economy. We're really in, we're not even in the economy of the 2000s. We're in, the economy continues to change in a very dynamic and rapid way. And in that vein, I would say that, it's a guidance almost is always going to be lagging as a way in which to look at what's happening. I think about what's happening here in the Bay Area right now, where unemployment across the board is below 4% in almost all 9 of our Bay Area counties. And, what guidance is going to come out around how we basically inform our investments is going to be very different than some other place in the nation that's still struggling economically to try to find its footing. So, there's it's important to have that federal view, but you have to understand that, each regional labor market looks very different. Each economy is very different. It's driven by private investment and spending, and that's where job creation really happens.
Stephen Bader, what's your question for Jim Bovard?
So, Jim, I guess, I appreciate your perspective. I think you've offered some great points and insights. I guess my question back to you is what do you think the role, if any, should be of government around these kinds of things relative to the, to supporting economic opportunity and growth for both businesses and workers?
My impression is the best thing that government can do is not throw wrenches into the engine. And I think the government's been doing that a lot. And some of the tax policies, some of the government regulations, they really stifled it. There is no substitute for real private jobs as far as that's the best way to get real job training. And when the government has policies which stifle job growth, private job growth, unsubsidized job growth, that is damning for the federal, that is damning for people acquiring new skills and new hope. And if you just, this is a bit of a side thing, but if you look at what the politicians in Los Angeles just did, raising the minimum wage to $15, this is a horrible thing for job training because studies going back 40 to 50 years show that minimum wage, part of the compensation that people get is on the job training. But when you raise the wage to $15 and many of the job applicants don't know know very little how to read and don't have a work history, it doesn't make sense for the businesses to waste time training them. So there are so many wrenches that politicians have thrown into the economic engine at all levels.
Let's turn now to closing statements, which, again, I'm hoping are not a reiteration of where you started the conversation. It's the goal is that you each were two intelligent guys who have a lot of experience, who shared a lot of very useful stuff with each other. So I'd like you, in fairness, because Stephen Bader started, Jim Bovard, I'd like you to start and make a closing statement about what you think. Put on your King Solomon wise man's hat.
Oh, my God. Well, I think I should put on my hip boots, too.
We have high standards here at NPR, though. No hip boots, but we have King Solomonic behavior is required. So you're King Solomon. You are the guy in charge of trying to improve in any way you can the employability of folks, either currently unemployed or somewhat employed. If you were the czar and your closing statement, what would you as Jim Bovard do to try to enhance the employability and the economy and for both employees and workers in the United States of America?
Well, it's a good question, one I've not really thought about, but the example I mentioned in my previous comment about minimum wage, the raising the minimum wage is damning for folks getting on folks who are relatively unskilled or have a short history of employment getting on the job training. There have been a lot of regulations, a lot of liability. I've written a number of stories on the EEOC and how some of their crackdowns are disrupting hiring. I think there's going to be a lot of adverse employment effect from Obamacare. And if the politicians would, it's frustrating to see decade after decade the politicians promising to solve the problem, and then last year you have Obama admitting that, well, we're just relying on train and pray. And it doesn't matter how many times that politicians fail to provide the goods. Many people think that we still have to trust them to solve the problem. Politicians aren't going to do this. Politicians are not going to fix the problem. I've spent quite a bit of time at the Labor Department headquarters. It's often difficult to find people working there. There's a very different ethos there, and it's just like you spend time there, and you don't want to put those folks in charge of job training or employment or almost anything. And folks need to be more self-reliant.
Okay. Stephen Bader, same question, of course, to you. If you were the czar of job enhancement for folks, you had fiat power, no bureaucracy, no illogical government changing regulations. You are the czar. You can use as much government or as little government as you want in any ways. What would you do?
Well, I think as a start, Marty, right away, you know, the old paradigms of, you know, and train and pray is an old paradigm. It's not the new paradigm. It's really about aligning with the market and where are things going globally. You know, things that are happening across the world right now, you know, that what's happening in terms of new technologies and the disruptive effect that those have on industries and on work opportunities, you know, innovation and new technologies and how those help to change and evolve the kinds of things that are available for workers and businesses. And fundamentally, how do you leverage that into an opportunity? And so to my way of thinking, this is really about, you know, linking, aligning, and leveraging what's happening in the market with what's with the resources that are coming in to support some kind of basic public infrastructure in terms of education, economic development, and workforce development that really is going to give, you know, workers a fair shot, but also help businesses compete. Because there's no doubt about the fact right now that a lot of businesses, you know, in the United States are struggling mightily with what's happening across the globe and how do they stay afloat and stay competitive in this environment. So it's really about sort of rethinking some things and looking at, again, strong, you know, P3s, public-private partnerships that can help really move this agenda forward. Because the old paradigms that have happened in the past, no doubt I would agree wholeheartedly with Jim, and they can't be repeated.
I just got an idea before I let you go. I was going to let you go right at this point, but having listened to both of you, and because, you know, I do have a background in evaluation because I am a career counselor, I want to try to integrate what I've learned from both of you plus my own knowledge into telling you what I would do and then have each of you respond to what I would do if I were the czar. So first of all, I would, and I'm sure this will please you, Jim, I would rescind the $450 million immediately. I would not dispel it because if there is not good evaluation data, we've got to damn get it. I care about those $450 million are not coming from nowhere. They're coming from human beings who are struggling in the shrinking middle class. And I would I wouldn't say I'm canceling it. I'm saying I'm suspending the dispensation of that $450 million until I had good evaluation data, the best we could. Nothing, the perfect is the enemy of the good. I'm not saying we need perfect. But until we had damn good evaluation data on what works with what populations in what circumstances, I would then say, here are our 10 model programs, or three, or one, or here is, maybe there are no model programs, but here are the things we know work and the things we don't know work. I now want to receive grants. I am the czar, right? I want to receive grants from any agencies, public or private, that feels that they can create a program that is going to address all of these best practices, avoid the bad ones, and serve this segment of the population. Nobody can serve everybody. Serve this population, and I will look, and I will have a series of program evaluators review the grants as well as people who have spent their life in the field, both on the more big government side, more on the libertarian side. I would have a dream team of brilliant, fair-minded people review those proposals, and I would give out that $450 million a year from now based on that. Either of you want to start with your reaction to that?
Stephen, go ahead.
Sure. Well, I think there's a couple things. You know, the $450 million being talked about, first and foremost, let's be clear, that's coming out of the Trade Adjustment Act. That's coming out of what's, you know, I was just describing before about, you know, the disruption in the global economy and the fact that there's money, you know, that the nation's losing in terms of it as its competitiveness. And this is an investment back in workers and businesses to help them compete. I would also submit that, you know, there actually is better evaluation data out there than folks may realize, but that, in fact, part of the problem has been that the messaging around it has been poor. And when things aren't messaged well, then they aren't understood. And, you know, to Marty's point, while I think there's some merit in what you're suggesting, I think we really have to understand that macro design does not always work in terms of local delivery. So you can design, you know, these elegant things out of D.C. that look, you know, beautiful and brilliant, but when you come down to the community level, what works in Chicago may not work in L.A. and it may not work in Seattle, but it works in Chicago. You know, so you have to really look at how those play out in regional economies.
That's precisely what I said, that I would get proposals from locals that based on some principles that seem to work. Okay, your reaction, Jim Bovard.
Well, you know, it's always good to hear a Solomon Wise Man proposal, and it sounds great to have a solid evaluation, to have a green team, as you said, a brilliant, fair-minded people that would pass that out. But if this is going to be run by the Labor Department, then I'm trying to keep this clean-minded. But I was sitting here and I had one flashback on one detail that would capture why I feel what I could do about the Labor Department. I was investigating them back in the 1980s, late 80s, and one of the programs which they were funding in Washington, D.C. was the Mayor Barry Youth Leadership Institute, which was part of the summer jobs program, in which they basically had kids sitting around and shooting the bull and, you know, teasing each other. But the whole idea that the Labor Department would finance a Mayor Barry Youth Leadership, which was also involved in Get Out the Vote drives in Washington, D.C., at the time that Barry was utterly in one scandal after another, there is not good judgment, and there won't be at the Labor Department. There's no way to fix labor.
Well, on that unfortunate note, we must bring this to a conclusion, but I certainly do appreciate both of you. I do think that we did a good job of bringing out all the issues one way or the other, and that is what public radio should be about, and that's at least what I aspire to. So I profoundly am appreciative. I know it's stressful, by the way, to be in these conversations and debates. So, Stephen Bader, thank you very both of you for being respectful, dealing with the stress, and helping to enlighten our listeners. Thank you both, Stephen Bader and Jim Bovard, for being my guests on Work with Marty Nemco.
Hey, thanks, Marty.
Yeah, thank you, Marty.
Okay. And now we turn to you. As you know, very often in the first part of the show, we deal with the macro issues of affecting workforce and society. It would be short-sighted to just focus on individuals when there are, as Stephen Bader was saying, there are amazing mega vectors, forces that are impacting the middle class, the working class, the poor, and the rich. In this society, jobs are changing dramatically, and their presence is unfortunately declining. Good jobs, good pay, full-time, benefited, secure jobs, that are pro-social, they're holy grails that are unfortunately too rarely found. So it's very important, I believe, on the show to devote significant time to the macro issues of what the hell are we going to do about it. But I also care about you as an individual. So you, my dear listeners, who have listened at the 30,000-foot level to this first part of the show, if you or someone you care about is struggling, I don't care if you're rich and unhappy or you're destitute, poor and miserable, or you're in that hollowed-out middle class or hollowing out and are desperately trying to hold on to your middle-class job or trying to start a business in a difficult time with lots of burdens being put on employers, practical or psychological, whatever your problem is, we do what are called workovers on this show. So I invite you to call in, and I will, and the price, fortunately, is right, zero, zippo, nada. I will certainly give you my best shot. I'm now in my 26th year doing this, and I look forward to helping you. And this is the right time to call before the lines get jammed up. So the phone number, if you or someone you love has a work problem, wants a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW Radio. And while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, what I'd like to do is just...